welcome to another edition of Book Talk. I'm Stephen Usry, and I'm pleased to welcome Marla Frazee to the program today. Marla is an author and illustrator of children's books. She's won 2 Caldecott medals, and her books include Santa Claus, the World's Number One Toy Expert, The Boss Baby, and The Farmer and the Clown. Today we'll be talking about her latest book, Little Brown, which is about a cranky little dog who is living in a shelter with other dogs who aren't cranky. So Marla, are you really not cranky?
You know, I am sometimes quite cranky. Actually, it's funny because I think I often have characters in my books who are cranky, and sometimes I, you know, get sort of overwhelmed by things. But I think deep down, I'm actually a pretty positive person. So I think it's an interesting kind of combination of the way I actually am in my life and the way I tell stories.
But why do you think these cranky characters command your attention?
I think because since I was a little kid, I've been very aware of how things are hard for me to sort of do. Like, I think life is kind of, is, as I said, overwhelming. And when I was little, I remember just having a really hard time going to school. Like, I was afraid to do it. I was shy. It seemed scary. I didn't want to go. I had to. You know, as I got used to it, it became absolutely a great part of my life. But everything that was new was hard for me. So whether it was spending the night at a friend's house or going to sleepaway camp or going on field trips as a kid, or even when I was a little bit older, just, you know, the idea of going away to college in a town that was not where I grew up, you know, things like that have always been hard. And pretty soon I'm going overseas. I've been taking a couple trips this year. I'm calling 2018 my year of international travel. I'm already getting that same sort of bubbling up feeling of, that I felt when I had to go to kindergarten for the first time. It's like, oh my gosh, this is going to be scary.
Where
and
are
then
you
once
headed to?
I do it, I'm thrilled. It's great. I'm going to Israel, and I'm going to go talk about some of the books, and it's going to be great. I'm looking forward to it. So, yeah, it's a trip that sort of came together in a very serendipitous way, and I'm looking forward to it.
I talked to another author, and I apologize for getting who this person is, but they said one of the most wonderful things is that you can't see just me in one or two of my characters. I have to put a bit of me in all of my characters. Do you feel that way?
I do, actually. I feel like I've heard that about dream theory, too. If you are to analyze your dreams, you are really actually all the characters, and, you know, you're working through your issues with whatever show up in your dreams. And so I do feel like there's a part of that.
For 80s music fans, there was a song called Golden Brown by this British band called The Stranglers. And there was a lyric in the song that says, "Never a frown with Golden Brown, but with Little Brown, that's about all he has."
Oh, that's funny. No, I'm not familiar with that song, but that's very funny.
It's a beautiful song, uh-huh. But Little Brown is not very happy.
Uh-huh. I'm not even sure where this name came from. I didn't really concoct it in any sort of way, except that it was a little brown dog. And I felt like this is the character in my new book called Little Brown. And I knew Little Brown was going to be cranky, and none of the other dogs were going to play with him. And the big question of the book is Little Brown cranky because no one will play with him, or do the other dogs not play with him because he's cranky?
It's a chicken and egg question.
Right. So it's a sort of existential question that doesn't really get answered in the book. But I was thinking of this dog as, there are 16 other dogs in the book, the ones that are playing together, and they seem totally well adjusted, and they all have names. And I just felt like Little Brown wouldn't or shouldn't in this context have, you know, a specific name. I think that it kind of gave him more of an outsider status, that he just doesn't even have a name. And so that's where it came from for me.
But did your publisher think that naming him after a rival publisher?
Well, I think maybe because we're dealing with, you know, literary people, there's no comma, so it seemed very, and commas are important. It seemed like it just never came up.
With the muted colors in the art, why did you choose that palette?
At first, I was trying to determine what this setting was. You know, where were they? In my mind, at first, they were at a dog park. So I went to a couple dog parks and took a lot of pictures and the dog park near my house happens to just not have any grass that will grow there, so it's really brown. and there's a chain link fence around it. And so I was sort of at first maybe focused on that setting. But the more I thought about the book, I got rid of the dog park because I didn't want any of the dogs to actually be with their own people. I wanted them to be, you know, more in a shelter situation so that there weren't like the people that bring the dogs to the dog park and then call them home. It was just too many characters, and it kind of took away from the situation of having the dogs be in their own world. And so then once I went to the idea of a shelter, I know there are many shelters that are not bleak, but there's something about that shelter being, you know, these dogs are either, you know, waiting to see if they're going to get a home, or, you know, they've been maybe lost and then brought there. There could be many circumstances that it just felt like that palette was going to support the idea of they don't have homes. And so even though the toys are different, there's a lot of color in the toys, that sort of,
but they're even a little bit dialed back on the
brightness. Yeah, they are dialed back. And I mean, I felt like I was dealing with a pretty serious issue here. Like, this is a social dynamic that doesn't really have great answers. I think we've all been in a situation, no matter how old we are, and that would include really young children, all the way up to people who maybe are at the end of their life. I think we've all been in a situation where either we're not being played with or we're not wanting to play with somebody. And often it's both. It could be happening at the same time and the same day. There's so many reasons why, and it's so hard to figure it out sometimes. I think it's even harder, I would think, for children who don't really have much agency about like where they're placed. I mean, I remember that was part of my, I think, issue about not wanting to go to school for the first time, because it's a big unknown. Like, you don't know anything. You finally maybe have gotten some sort of idea of how to control your daily life if you're a kid at home, and then all of a sudden, no, oh my gosh, now I'm out into the world, and what's that going to be? And so, you know, you don't have a whole lot of experience to draw on, and those questions just seem bigger.
I've talked to a couple of other adults who've read the book. My girlfriend's daughter, who's a teenager, she's read the book, and we won't give the ending away, but it's one that really elicits a response from the readers. How have you heard from children about the end of the book? I don't want to give it away, of course, but just the general mood.
Yeah, I won't give it away either, except to say that, you know, I don't think, well, it's a cliffhanger ending. That's the word that a lot of kids have used with me about it. Like, they'll say, you know, they'll just put up their hands and say, it's a cliffhanger. It's been fascinating, actually, to see the different responses and to watch or be privy to the conversations that groups of kids will have after they read the story. And, well, there's a certain response that I almost always hear first. Like, some child will raise their hand and have this brilliant idea. Like, they just blurt it out. This is what they think that should happen. And then we'll sit with that idea for a while. Would that work, actually? And then they realize, oh, it's not quite fail-safe. Like, that might not work, you know? And I actually wrote down some of the ideas that some kids have said. One of them said, they should get some ice cream and play together, all the dogs. Somebody said, I think Little Brown wants to be friends with his crankiness. I thought that was really fascinating and insightful, actually. I think sometimes we do feel like that about certain people. Like, they're really holding on to something that they need to sort of either, like, maybe a cranky attitude that they need to sort of protect themselves with.
Mm-hmm. There's a bit of comfort in it, too.
Yeah, right. Like, if I'm cranky, then it explains why maybe this whole thing is not satisfying to me. Like, I don't want to be here. I mean, I've seen people do that at parties. I've certainly done it myself. Like, I don't really want to be here. I'm just going to go stand up against the wall with my arms crossed.
It becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Yeah, exactly. One kid said, Little Brown is like me. I don't have any friends in school. And that was like a heartbreaker. But also just the idea that this kid could express something that's so vulnerable. Mm-hmm. You know, I felt like that was such a gift to me as the person who maybe helped that child to open up. And hopefully maybe there's more of a conversation that that child will be able to have or maybe a place to put it that could help change that dynamic. One child said, "Is Little Brown a kid or a grown-up?" And I thought, that's a really great question. Who knows? I loved that question because I actually do not think of these dogs as being kids. I mean, they're dogs of all ages, which I did put that in the book. Like the old dogs are doing this, the young dogs are doing this. So we have like pretty broad demographic of dogs. And then my favorite was this response. A child said, after a few days, actually, I was in a school in Singapore, actually, a huge American school in Singapore. And I was reading to the kids and talking to them over a 10-day period. So we had read Little Brown early in that time. And then later, I saw some of the kids again. And one child said, since the book doesn't tell us what happens, the story has lasted longer in my head. So he had been thinking about it, which is what he was trying to say, for days and days. And this child was in kindergarten. I thought that was pretty cool.
Yeah, for a child to have that much permanence in their thought.
Yeah, and to also be able to sit with the ambiguity of it. You know, I think that what I have seen is there are certain kids, just like certain adults, that do not like an ambiguous ending. It just bothers them.
I guess maybe because I'm more of an adult or a cynic at heart, or maybe maybe a pessimist might be a better way, that when I heard the term cliffhanger, I went, no, this is just the way it's going to be forever.
Yeah.
Let's talk a little bit more about the art.
Okay.
And with the illustrations kind of feather out at the edges, what about that kind of non-defined edge do you find appealing in your art?
Gee, what do I like about that? I do it a lot. I mean, I've done it in a couple other books too. I think I really like the white space of a book. I work with that a lot. I spend a lot of time designing the form of a picture book for children is really interesting to me. Typically, it's a 32-page exercise with both words and pictures telling a story and the page turn being super important. It's 32 pages because of the way a picture book is bound. And then you have like the end papers and the cover to tell the story and like the title page and various other elements. But within that 32 pages, you have to deliver, if you can, a fully realized story in words and pictures that, you know, resonates and hopefully will encourage the reader to go back again and again and again and read it. And it's a form that I'm endlessly challenged by and excited about. And I spend a lot of time building the structure of the story visually. So that's how I start. And so I'll do little thumbnail sketches and try and figure out, you know, is this going to be a double page spread with a full illustration across? Will there be a series of spot illustrations or vignettes? Sometimes it might be a full illustration on the right hand page and just text on the left and vice versa. And so playing with where to put the illustration, where to put the words, and the beats of the story. So I would say the beat of the story, like if it's a full bleed, double page spread illustration, that's a pretty strong beat visually. So it's almost like musically a chord that maybe it gets sustained for a while. And then if you turn the page and there's a bunch of little illustrations, it could be sort of a little musical, you know. And so I work with those beats and that rhythm a lot. And I like the white space that's part of that. So I don't think I've ever done a book. In fact, I know for a fact I've never done a book where it's been double page, full bleed, every single page. Because I think it just doesn't interest me because it doesn't have those strong beats and, you know, strong chords, lesser sustained notes, and all that stuff that I like to play with.
You have to change up the rhythm. You
can't,
yes. It's like in writing prose books, you can't have paragraphs and sentences all the same length. It gets very repetitive.
Exactly. And it's like that visually. So with the text too, you wouldn't want to have, you know, the same amount of words on each page. Maybe there might be one word on a page and then maybe a chunk of text or something on a different one. And then pictures too, like that. I like to change that up too.
I thought on the inside covers where you have all the characters, you have kind of like Polaroid pictures and their names underneath. And I thought it was just a very meta approach to paint Polaroid pictures.
It was pretty fun. I really liked it. And then the bulletin board, trying to figure out, you know, I wanted to set up the shelter idea. And I thought, you know, I've been to shelters and they have all the dogs or pets pictures on bulletin boards sometimes, and maybe little notes and little things about, you know, who they are and how long they've been there and how old they are. And so I kind of wanted to suggest that that was what was happening.
A few weeks ago, I spoke with Lauren Long.
Yes.
And he said that early on in his career, he got to judge a competition with you, and he said he learned more about picture books in just watching you consider what was vital in picture books than just about anything else in his life.
Oh, what a nice thing to say. He's such a great person and friend, and I love his work. Oh my gosh, his book that he just illustrated by Margaret Weiss Brown is brilliant. Yeah, I learned a lot from Lauren. It was wonderful. Like, we were on the phone just sort of talking through this competition, and it was fascinating because, you know, it was a competition judged by picture book illustrators, author illustrators, and, you know, we're looking at the work of our colleagues, and so it was really interesting for me as well.
For artists that are early on in their career, but both writers and illustrators, what is a common thing that you wish they could get past as quickly as possible?
Ha. I do teach. I have for quite a few years. And the thing that I think I wish they could get past is that we all have a tendency to feel that something that maybe comes easy to us or that we like, love maybe, no one else will care that much about. Like, yeah, I love that, but no one else will. And actually, the opposite is true. And for some reason, that's really difficult for people to remember. So that if you are just sort of passionate about, I don't know, wombats, and that's your thing, and all you want to do is tell stories about wombats and draw pictures of wombats, and you just live in the world of wombats. But you think maybe, this is the tendency, is that, you know, maybe no one's going to care about, I care about that, no one else is going to care about that, so maybe I should do books about, like, kittens, because everybody loves kittens in children's books. And so then they bring in these boring books about kittens because they really wish they could do books about wombats. That's just hard, I think, for people to recognize that the thing that feels like play to them and just, like, drives, like, the stuff that we love the most, that's where our stories are. That's what we should be doing, the stuff that makes us the happiest. And time and again, I have this kind of conversation with authors and illustrators, and I'll say, like, yeah, I know you're talking about this project, but what is going on here? And then I'll point to something maybe in the back of their sketchbook or, and the, oh, no, no, that's nothing. No, really, what is that? It's just something I just do in my spare time. No, but that's fascinating.
Now, when you're illustrating, is there a difference you feel while illustrating your own writing or when you're illustrating someone else's? Does the process feel different?
It does, actually. Well, when I illustrate something that somebody else has written, it's always something that just grabs me, and I'm so compelled to try and figure it out. It's something that would never have come out of my own head. And I think, like, this is fascinating. I wonder what this is going to be like. I wonder what this process of illustrating this will be. And so there's this safety net under it, though, because it already exists. I know what it is. I'm compelled by it and challenged by it, and I love it, and I feel like I can't not illustrate it. So it's, you know, I have all this energy about it. But it doesn't matter what I do or try, it still is going to be there, and then I can kind of try something else if it didn't work. If I'm both writing and illustrating it, I feel like the whole thing can fall apart pretty easily. Like, and I don't know which part is not working. Like, did I lose the thread of something that was important in the words? Maybe it's in the pictures. Maybe it's both. Maybe it doesn't work together, you know? So I've had a couple of projects that just have, it seemed like just fallen apart. And I thought, like, I thought that was a good idea, but it didn't work. And that happened with The Boss Baby. And I had to kind of take a break with that book. I thought it was funny. I thought I was really having a good time. What happened? And I had to sort of, you know, kind of commit to it again. And then I did figure it out, thank God. And I'm really happy about it. But at the time, I thought, no, I thought that worked, but it didn't work.
And a similarity between Boss Baby and Little Brown, they both feel they have to control the situation.
Oh, yeah. I wonder if that means something. Gee, probably. Yeah, probably does.
Can you give us a little peek onto what you might be working next?
I did a book called The Farmer and the Clown, and it was a wordless book. I don't know if
I've seen the cover, but I haven't read it.
And I didn't know it was going to be a wordless book. It was the first wordless book I had done. But the story sort of came to me visually. And when I started to work on it, I realized it was going to be a stronger story without words because it was about two characters who look a certain way. Cranky farmer and a smiley little baby clown. But who turn out to not be the way they actually look. Farmer's actually very soft-hearted and tender. And the smiling baby clown, actually, when he takes his makeup off, is really sad underneath the smile. So that kind of difference in the way they looked and the way they really were needed to be something that didn't have words explained, but just was something we saw, I thought. So it was a wordless book. And I loved working on it. And I never thought I would do a sequel of any kind to it. But last February, I started to kind of play out not only the next book, but the following book. So now I'm working on book 2 and 3, and it's going to be a trilogy. So the first one's The Farmer and the Clown, came out a couple of years ago. The next one is called The Farmer and the Monkey. And then the third one will be The Farmer and the Circus. So I'm working on the monkey one and the circus one.
Did you study mime or anything like that to kind of help you with an idea of a wordless book?
What's really funny about it is I don't really, like, people will say to me, The Farmer and the Clown, I don't really like clowns. And I'll say, yeah, I don't really like clowns either. And then I don't really like mimes either. I mean, I think it's an incredible thing to watch, but I don't gravitate toward clowns or miming or anything. But I've done a lot of books about circuses and that kind of thing. I don't know why. I was afraid of clowns when I was little. That's probably no surprise after this interview.
Well, you seem to be able to engage with things you're uncomfortable with in your art.
I guess.
Yeah, the ambiguity with the clowns and everything like that. I mean, you're courageous in what you're tackling.
Well, I think that is probably why I'm tackling it. I mean, that's the whole fundamental reason of what it kind of has me by the throat, and I have to try and wrangle it and figure it out a little bit. I think that's probably it. I think one of the reasons most people don't like clowns, after working on The Farmer and the Clown as long as I did and listening to people talk about it, I think the disconnect with the clown, at least for me, is they look a certain way, but that doesn't mean they actually are that way. You know, underneath that makeup and that artifice, they don't feel that way. And as a metaphor for pretty much everybody, like, I think that we have a sort of public persona. We go out in the world with it, you know, and I think that's why people don't like clowns. You know, it's sort of like a very obvious persona that it's like, well, I don't really buy that. I think underneath all that, you don't really feel that way. And I kind of wonder if that's why they're often used in horror movies and all kinds of things, because you don't really know who they are.
And it's a lack of nuance.
Yeah.
It doesn't seem genuine.
Yeah.
Do you know the old joke about the depressed man in Pagliacci?
No.
A very depressed man goes to a therapist and he goes, "Doctor, it's the depression. It's terrible. It's crippling." And the doctor says, "You need some cheering up. The great clown Pagliacci is in town tonight for one night only. You have to go see him." And the guy goes, "But doctor, I am Pagliacci."
That's good. That's a good one.
Well, Marla, I want to thank you so much for taking a few minutes out and talking to us. It's really been a pleasure.
It was a pleasure for me, too. Thank you.
Marla Frazee is the author of the picture book, Little Brown, which is published by Beach Lane Books. I'm Stephen Usery, and this is Book Talk.
Thank you for joining us today. Book Talk is recorded in the studios of WIPL in Memphis, Tennessee. If you have any questions or comments, you can email us at WIPLFM@gmail.com or write to us at Book Talk, care of WIPL, 3030 Poplar Avenue, Memphis, Tennessee, 38111, or call us at 901-415-2752.